Tonight on Arena, composer and conductor Eimear Noone talks to us ahead of her Electric Arcade concert this Friday, and season 2 of Apple TV's Ted Lasso is on the way. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Eimear Noone, one of the world's most accomplished composers of scores for video games, having brought soundscapes such as World of Warcraft to over 100 million fans, one of many musical soundscapes that Eimear has composed. She's also one of our most successful international conductors. And in 2020, she made history by becoming the first female conductor to take the baton at the 92nd Academy Awards ceremony. This Friday, July the 23rd, Eimear will conduct the RTE National Symphony Orchestra in an evening of curated music entitled Eimear Noone's Electric Arcade. The show will take place at the National Concert Hall in Dublin. Be the last of this season for the RTE National Symphony Orchestra live. Delighted to have Eimear with me in studio this evening. I know I said to you even before we started, Eimear, I had spoken to you just shortly after the awards ceremony, the Oscars. But little did you know then that that was going to be the last one for quite a while, last kind of full-on proper ceremony. That must have been some night, though, up there conducting an orchestra with a big audience like that.
Yeah, it's very surreal at this point because, you know, we went from that ceremony and everybody's sitting next to each other and the orchestra all squished together and everything, and to, you know, this unbelievable global catastrophe. And, you know, for musicians in particular, I keep saying this, you know, music isn't our job, it's who we are, and being together is what we do. And I mean, you know, the French word ensemble, that literally means together. So we haven't just, thankfully, besides the horrors of the health situations, for us, we're bereft in a different way. Yeah. So getting together with the orchestra and rehearsing today with these fabulous rock musicians as well. It was just like family. It was great.
And could you actually rehearse properly all in the same room? Or do you have slightly depleted forces just in terms of the spacing that still has to be carried out on stage?
Well, we are taking every precaution, and we started rehearsal late because negative COVID test, the text message hadn't come in yet, and we're waiting for everybody's text message. And yeah. I have to say the orchestra's team has been fantastic. The extra considerations, they're totally safety first about the musicians and, of course, the audience. But we are spread out. But this program exists in this format because I totally believe as a creative you embrace the limits you allow limits to help you create something that might not otherwise have existed. So this is a smaller group, but it might even be a louder group because we have the heavy guitars in and we have the drums, and it's going to be really fun.
Yeah, and I suppose in some ways it's one of the things about if you're composing for video, for games, that is, or for the screen, in fact, for film, there are often limitations on the creative process in that you're asked for, I want 20 seconds of music here, or I want 30 seconds that can loop around, and if it needs to go on for a minute and a half in the case of a game, then it has to be able to expand and contract in that fashion. So I suppose you're well used to making music that has a kind of an inbuilt adaptability.
Well, you know what? There's nothing new about that because, you know, Webern wrote really, really short piano pieces, and composers all throughout music. Mozart wrote opera. So, you know, you have Tchaikovsky and his ballets. There's so many collaborations between composers and all types of media. It just makes sense that today we have, and if you're writing something that has incidental music in a play, whatever, you know, you'll have different lengths of string to work with, and you have to cut your cloth to your measure and all those cliches. But it's interesting because it's a kind of a puzzle as well as being something that you want to be really, really creative with. So part of the challenge and part of the fun is taking those limitations and creating something that you might not otherwise have done.
Exactly. Just as you said it there, I realised, you're sure that's exactly the case it would be in the pit at a live ballet performance, where the dancer might do 8 pirouettes or 12 or 16 or 24, depending on how he or she is feeling. And the conductor has to be awake to that, and the music has to allow the possibility of those extra, or if the dancer isn't feeling up to it, no, get out of it after 8 bars and move on.
Yeah.
So that adaptability has always been there, as you say.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Adaptability is key, and I mean, musicians. I think that's true of this past year, over a year, that creatives are so used to being adaptable. That, you know, at the worst of times for musicians, so many have created and continued to create. And it's, you know, it's like that when that's who you are, that's who you are. You can't all of a sudden, you know, learn how to breathe through gills. You know, it's just that's what we do.
I'm going to, now this isn't particularly you or specifically to do with you, I don't think, but I want to bring you back 30 years. Have a little listen to this. Off it goes and continues on.
Yeah. Happy birthday, Sonic.
Do you remember when you first heard that piece of music? It is the Sonic the Hedgehog, the part of the soundtrack, obviously, from the game.
Yeah, these things are so embedded in our pop culture that I don't even remember when I first encountered Sonic, you know. But what I do remember is being a kid and hearing these game scores and kind of hearing that the intention was that the orchestra would be involved, maybe not Sonic, but a lot of, say, Koji Kondo's Zelda stuff, and you hear it and you're like, oh my God, I can totally imagine this in the orchestra. And the thing was, the technology wasn't powerful enough to contain all of that massive information that comes with orchestral recording. But it didn't stop the composers from thinking that way, you know.
So even maybe, as you say, maybe not in the Sonic, but in some early video game music, you were hearing a potential career or not, I'm not sure, but you were hearing, I think there could be an orchestra there with that piece of music if the technology could hold the recording.
Yeah, I think certain composers, that's they were going for with, you know, again, with the limitations, trying to create what they could. And there's one sort of interesting thing about those early days, which is the composers were often programmers as well. So they'd have to program every single pitch, note by note. So every note was decided upon in a very particular way, and it was really, really important because you had to spend a lot of time just inputting the stuff. So that's my theory on why Koji Kondo created so many earworms like Mario and Zelda and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and now here we are 30 years later, and getting the digital recording of an orchestra onto a game, you know, it's not quite child's play, but it's certainly, there's a lot more possible now. When you started composing, was it straight into games and film? Was that immediately where you sent yourself, or were there other stuff going on as well?
No, shout out to Imro, because I think I was about 17. I was on the Ennis Imro Composition Summer School, and they were so good. They brought in renowned composers from all over Europe and South America to teach about 10 of us. And we were so, so spoiled. And I was writing atonal music and serial music as a teenager. So I started with dissonance and went backwards. But it was important to me to be able to communicate emotionality and to create something that might paint a picture in somebody else's imagination or move somebody. So I wanted to know how that worked. And I felt that the tonality of film music in particular lent itself to what we would call, back in music history, affect in music, pulling forth the emotions. So
there's no doubt that there's tonality and great melodic quality in what we're about to listen to. Malach, explain this piece, first of all, what you composed it for. Those who know the game will know it immediately, but those who don't won't.
Yeah, this is from World of Warcraft, Warlords of Draenor. And it's Malach is a Hebrew word, and it means an angel messenger. It's the spirit of a child that can bring a message directly to the ears of God.
La 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 la
God, you're laughing even as we listen to that, Eimear Noonan. That's a Malak, some of Eimear Noonan's music, which we'll be hearing at this concert, this coming up with this concert. You will be playing that on Friday night, the concert.
An electrified version.
An electrified version of that. Now, you explained to me going into it, Eimear, that Malak was a Hebrew word, but just as we were, before I took down the fader there, we heard the words very, even you queued me up to listen out for exulegia.
Yeah, so when we're writing for video games or often for films as well, you're told not to use a specific language. A perfect example is if you know the Gladiator score, the stunning vocal by Lisa Gerrard, and she's sort of intuiting that language that's not of any specific culture. So the people, you don't get in the way of people's imagination or their experience, but I sneak Irish in whenever I can. So I write it out phonetically. So I'm in China listening to Exulegia, and it's spelled Exulegeaheh.
It makes total sense in terms of what you were saying about that particular piece, because the Hebrew word Malak means, remind me again.
Yeah, it's actually a title that's given at the end of a child's name, like we'd have a squire or something, but it's the spirit of a child that can take a message directly to the ears of God.
Yeah, and Exulegia then translating directly as walking with God, literally. Yeah. So even though you're using sound as much as anything else, you have that little extra layer of meaning in there for yourself.
Well, I think it translates there's a big Exodus theme in there, and I always have people contact me online and say, what's behind this? What does this mean? And that means everything to me, because you're hearing from people from all over the world, and it just shows you that truly music, it speaks to us on a human level, on a very visceral level, no matter what our background or culture. And that's one of the things that's really never spoken about in gaming, is you have people going on online quests and guilds with people from other cultures, language, sort of English really is the gaming language. But it breaks down barriers of all kinds, culturally, physically, all of these things. And we always hear about the shoot 'em ups and the violent aspect, but we don't really talk about how it brings people of different cultures together in an online space to have fun and play, you know.
And when you get that, those shoot 'em ups, as you call them, and the violent aspects, have you tried to play against that musically, or do you just have to go with it musically?
Well, I have two little boys as well, and it's like this, you know, we tried to keep away any toy guns and everything, and then they point their fingers at things, you know, and I realized that it's more about hitting a target than anything else. But when it comes to those, I mean, what's meaningful to me is that people are hearing the orchestra through their video game consoles. And what's happening is the sonority, that sound, is becoming the music of people's music. It's not, oh, this is of a different century, of a different era, or my grandparents' music. This is my music. And I hear from people all the time. I've literally shaken hands with, I'd say, tens of thousands of video game music fans at this point. And they say to me, well, my favorite song is from Skyrim. My favorite song is from this. And then I say to them, does that mean your favorite band is the orchestra? And they go, oh, I suppose so.
Yeah. And I suppose when you think about it, so often in youth orchestras, you see this as well, where you'll get arrangements of film music or arrangements of gaming music, which is a way of opening up the world of classical music, the world of the orchestra, and just that wonderful instrument that is the orchestra. It's just a way of opening that up that isn't old men with white wigs composing music.
Well, the old men with the white wigs wrote absolutely stunning music, and my hope is that this is my friend Christopher Tin. We're performing his Baba Yetu as the first Grammy-winning song from a video game. But Chris, he feels the way I do about the orchestra. And, you know, our passion is that, you know, the way I love Brahms and the way I love Mahler, that people come to video game music and go further and discover why we love the orchestra so much. He calls it a gateway drug to classical music.
Well, there you go. Well, I suppose if you open the door, you know, people, those who listen can go and find out more. But if you don't open the door, well, then they'll just walk right past it, won't they? You mentioned mentioned Baba Yetto. This beauty. It features the Soweto Gospel Choir, this particular recording that we're going to listen to. This is from your friend, what did you say his name was?
Christopher
again?
Tin.
Christopher Tin. Baba Yetto, Yetto, Liemjina, La Pueli, Tukuzbe. Baba Yetto, Yetto. There's a little section there of Baba Yetto featuring the Soweto Gospel Choir. It's one of the pieces that Eimear Noonan will be performing with the RTE National Symphony Orchestra this coming Friday evening as part of her Electric Arcade. But as you were saying, as we were listening to that, Eimear, you can't have a choir because of COVID. So yeah. How have you adapted that piece for Friday night's concert?
Well, I mean, all of this music's really strong and strong music bears all kinds of interpretation and arrangement. So we have four fantastic soloists that I absolutely love. And it'll be a different flavour. The arrangements are a different flavour. And that's to be... You know, you got to have different flavors.
Yeah,
you
wanna, absolutely. Yeah. I should also mention, you have something, some of your music will be heard. We've been talking a lot about the Galway Film Fla this week on the programme, obviously. What have you got? You've an animated film that you composed the music for that's been shown at the Fla, yeah?
Yeah, they're showing it outdoors on Saturday at 12 o'clock. I'm bringing my kids and stuff. It'd be great. We're doing a film, we scored a film called 2x2 Overboard. And it's just such a great, big-hearted story. And the producer, Mo Honan, is Galway-based. So yeah. I'm biased all over that, upside down, inside out. But we recorded it here in Dublin at Windmill. And the orchestra did a fabulous job. And it was like a total party. A big reunion, really, because I went to college and College of Music and everything with a lot of the players. But... yeah, we got locked down on in the middle of it and had to adapt again. But
Such is the way of things at
exactly.
the moment. And just one other thing. What are you doing with Stuart Copeland from The Police?
Yeah, Stuart is... I wrote the opening for his Police Deranged show, and Craig as well, my husband, we did some arranging on his show. And we're doing... He's written an opera with Chrissy Hynde that I'm working on with him as well. So... really, really special guy. And we're very, very fond of him in our house. So right. So that's been a really fun one.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you further when the Stuart Copeland thing all happens and whatever else happens, because it just seems as if the star keeps ascending and may it continue to do so for a long time for you, Eimear. Lovely to have you with us this evening and to speak to you. Thanks for coming
Sean.
In.
Sean. Thanks so much.
That's Eimear Noonan. And Electric Arcade takes place this Friday, the 23rd of July, 7 p.m. Selected programme of some of the greatest music written for gaming, curated by and conducted by Eimear Noonan, who will take the baton in front of the kind of slightly different version of the RTE National Symphony Orchestra. Sounds very exciting. It's the last concert in the current RTE National Symphony Orchestra live season. It will be streamed live from the National Concert Hall at 7 p.m. on rte.ie/culture. The American comedy series Ted Lasso is back for a second season. The first season introduced us to the US college football coach Ted Lasso, played by Jason Sudeikis, who is hired by an English Premiership football club, the owner of that team, Rebecca Welton. Even though Ted has no experience in the sport, Rebecca had wanted revenge by sinking her cheating ex-husband's football club, AFC Richmond, which she now owns. But Ted's yokel charm, optimism and homespun philosophy wins over even his biggest opponents. Season 2, Rebecca, Ted and the AFC Richmond. They may have dropped out of the Premiership, but at least the management team are working together. A whole heap of other problems come to dog the team. The first of them in the form of a dog, in fact. Their beloved mascot, Earl, Lisa Fallon, has been watching season 2 and she's with me in studio this evening. Yeah, I reckon there'd be something in there about dog, okay. First of all, Lisa, we should explain that you're coming to this with an absolute and total knowledge of football and all of the dynamics that go on in football teams. Just give us the shortened version of the CV when it comes to you in football?
So I'm the head coach of the Galway United men's first team. So we're a full-time professional team in the League of Ireland. And I suppose prior to that, I worked with Northern Ireland men's national team for 6 years, Cork City for 5.5 years. And then I had a spell over in England with Chelsea. So I went from being an analyst to a coach and now to head coach. So, I've been around the game for quite over a decade now.
And the sort of character that, in fact, should be in Ted Lasso, there must be a part for you in there somewhere with that trajectory in terms of the career. So when you're looking at this series, you know the kind of personalities that are involved. You know the sort of dynamics that are involved in teams. Dare I say, even the egos that might be involved in teams. How realistic is Ted Lasso, the series? What does it manage to hit in terms of football that you think is important?
I think it's so clever. I think it's the humour wouldn't be lost on anyone that works in football, for sure. And certainly anyone who watches it. It's not often I watch something and it actually makes me laugh out loud. Mm. It's really fun. I remember the first one I watched, I was kind of watching it going, oh, I'm not sure about this, because there's like a lot of language. It's very fruity, not too dissimilar to the game itself or the industry itself, but it goes straight for the jugular in terms of sexism, bullying, misogyny, corruption, deviousness. And it's like, wow, are they really going that quickly? And no holds barred, there's no subtlety.
Yeah.
But what it does, what's so clever about it, is it hits those topics in one or two lines and then comes straight back with incredible humour to lighten it, to touch on it. So it's a bit of a mirror into the industry.
And in some ways, there's racism there as well, if you like, in the basic setup. What they're doing with the Jason Sudeikis character, the setup was that he's brought in from America. He was an American football coach. He's brought in because he'll be hopeless.
Yeah, no, this goes after every single stereotype that you can think of. You know, there's a Dutch footballer and he's the one that kind of just speaks from the heart and doesn't think and doesn't really reflect the mood or recognise the mood of certain times. And it really goes after different stereotypes, the Nigerian players, the women in the boardroom, the women in the role of the women in the club. It goes after all of it, but in a very subtle, ironic, sarcastic, funny way. But it's very clever the way it's done, because it touches on very, very serious issues and very strong issues. But it does it in a way that probably makes people reflect and look and go, God, do I do that? Which is what's really clever about it.
It does make you kind of look into which of these footballers would I be if I were on a football
team. And I think most people could watch it and you look, it's a little bit like The Office. That you look and anyone who works in an office could probably pick out every character in The Office and say, they're in my office. Yeah. And this is exactly the same.
It has that similar dynamic to The Office, because effectively you're talking about a group of people working together. But let's kind of find out where it left us at the end of season one. You mentioned about the women in the football club, and one of the most important women in the football club is Rebecca Welton, played by Hannah Waddingham. Now, her ex-husband, owned the football team, so she wants to pull the team down. That's what the basic setup was. She spent the whole first series trying to wreck the thing and brought in Ted Lasso, the Jason Sudeikis character, as an American football coach who would know nothing about it. And she had tried right throughout the first season of the series to pull him down and to destroy the team, but she failed. And here she is towards the end of season one explaining to Ted what she has done. And she, as you said, Lisa, is fruity in her use of language as well. I think after 3 seconds in this clip,
I have something I need to tell you. I'm a fucking bitch.
Nope, that's new.
Ted, I lied to you. I hired you because I wanted this team to lose. I wanted you to fail. And I sabotaged you every chance I've had. It was me who hired that photographer to take the photo of you and Keely. I set up the interview with Trent Crim, hoping that he would humiliate you. And I instigated the transfer of Jamie Tart, even though you'd asked me not to. This club is all that Rupert has ever cared about, and I wanted to destroy it, to cause him as much pain and suffering as he has caused me. And I didn't care who I used or who I hurt. All you good people just trying to make a difference. Ted, I'm so sorry. If you want to quit or call the press, I'll completely understand.
I forgive you.
You what? Why?
Divorce is hard. And it doesn't matter if you're the one leaving or if you're the one who got left.
There we go. Clip from season one of Ted Lasso. Lisa Fallon with me in studio this evening. Who did we hear in that clip? Jason Sudeikis as Ted, the American coach who's come to England, and Rebecca Welton, played by Hannah Waddingham. So that was where they were left at the end of season one. Season two, everything does seem to be working much better now. And they are collaborating, the entire team, on a much better way this time, Lisa.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I love about this is it is a story about a football club, but it's actually a story about all the people. So yeah. You actually get a real insight into who they are, what their characteristics are, but actually what makes them who they are. And that's what probably season two goes in a little bit deeper into, all those little nuances of each person, their backstories, what's happened to them to make them the way they are, and the level of understanding that people get when they see those insights. So there's a lot of, one of the major themes in season two is vulnerability. People allowing themselves to feel vulnerable in order to connect or to get a bit more out of someone or to understand someone they found difficult. And it's really clever like that. But you do go a little bit deeper, and it probably becomes a little bit more like a drama in season two, but it still has the humour. Like one of my favourite scenes is when Ted arrives at the club. He's out and he's touching the grass, and you see the groundsman bolting across the pitch. Get off the pitch, get off the pitch, get off the pitch.
I'm sure he's not saying it that politely.
Yeah, but it's just like, it's like every character that you know and everything that they traditionally do. Like, I don't know any groundsman who a little bit of them inside doesn't die every time someone walks on a football pitch.
Why are they playing
don't
football
play
on my
yeah,
grass?
It's great in that sense, but the stories do go deeper. The characters do reveal a bit more, and it does get a little bit darker, for a want of a better word.
Yeah.
But it still has that humour that you can really draws you in. You really get connected to the characters.
I was talking about your career trajectory earlier on. One of the things that this season two will deal with is the career trajectory of a football player who basically has had to retire young. Because is it injury that made, what's his name, Roy Kent? I wonder what that is now. Roy Kent.
Roy Kent, yeah.
He had to retire early.
Yeah, so he's the hard man of the team. Yeah. He is the tough, bulgy guy. He's tough as nails, doesn't take any
messing
from anyone. but he's, and he's probably, he would remind me of Roy Keane, actually, you know. And then when he retires, the girlfriend is trying to get him into football punditry and he's having none of it.
Yeah, let me play a clip that Keely is the girlfriend. Keely is the girlfriend here, played by Juno Temple, and Roy Kent is played by Brett Goldstein. So she's suggesting that he might go into punditry.
Sky Sports reached out again.
No.
I think it's a good idea.
Last time I did one of your good ideas, I made a fucking fool of myself.
Your retirement press conference was beautiful, Roy. People loved it. It got like 15 million views.
Wait, so your way of alleviating my embarrassment is to tell me how many millions of people have seen me look like a knob?
Good point. I just want to go on record saying that I think you'd be an amazing pundit.
I don't want to be a fucking football pundit.
We could only play 28 seconds of that clip because the next, I think it is, 20 seconds of that are basically bad language, why he explains why he doesn't want to be a football pundit.
Yeah.
And it really gets that. And we do see him doing a scene of football punditry.
Yeah, so he eventually gives in and Keely convinces him to go and do it because he's missing the game. He's been coaching an under-11 girls team like they're a full-on professional Premier League men's team. It's very funny. And again, the language and the way he speaks to the kids is just like, oh, it's... it touches on that
subject.
Did
you recognise that kind of football coach who is forceful in, I suppose in your case it would be in her endeavours?
No, I think. Listen, every coach has their own style, and I think you have to be assertive at times. But Roy is certainly very assertive when he's dealing with the under 11 girls team. But he does go into the punditry, and what is really brilliant is he goes in, and he actually it's Sky Sports, it's Gillette Soccer Saturday. Jeff Stelling is there, Chris Kamara, these actual people. He's on the panel with them, and it just brings real credibility to the whole theme of what they're trying to achieve. And obviously he blows a gasket like we would expect Roy Kent to do, he's unbelievable. He's very eloquent, shall we say, in his remarks about talking about former teammates and managers and all sorts. So
several tweets from members of the Galway United football team here with the word assertive and 45 exclamation marks after it. I don't know what that means, Lisa. Assertive, yes. I would love to know what your version of assertive is. You have that smile that, of course, as you're being assertive, you've got a very strong fist behind the smile, I would guess. However, let's stick with Ted Lasso. We heard a bit about a character called Jamie Tart, who's just failed. He was with the team and then was relegated got out of it.
So Jamie Tart is the ego, the good-looking guy who loves his hair, who, when he celebrates or when he scores all the goals, not really a team player. When he scores, he goes off and celebrates on his own, and the rest of the lads are going, oh. He's the story. He's actually with Keely in the first series. But in the second series, at the end, he leaves Richmond and he signs for Matt. He goes back. He was on loan, and Rebecca obviously allows him to go back to Man City on loan. They play in the last game of the season, and basically his assist relegates Richmond.
Right, yeah.
So he goes down. Then he goes on this reality TV
Lust
show.
Lust Conquers All. I wonder what that's based on. They're all on an island together and Lust Conquers All.
So he steps away from Man City to do the reality TV series. And you can imagine how that goes.
And scoring comes to mean something else.
That's what he says. He says he scores as much there as he does on the pitch. And then he comes back. Man City refused to take him back. So he's kind of left in between a bit of a rock and a hard place. Contacts Keely to try and build some bridges with Richmond, which he ends up doing ultimately. And then he goes back I suppose he has a bit to prove in the dressing room.
I'd say. Now, I've only seen a couple of episodes and I was giving some of my thoughts as to what might or might not happen. Have you watched the entire series at this point?
Yeah.
And loved all of the second season?
Yeah, listen, it goes in a direction I didn't think it would, actually. You know, story goes kind of quite deep, and but the characters go much, much deeper than I thought.
Yeah, and I think it certainly you have the sense that the new character, the sports psychologist, that she is going to bring everything off in a whole new direction. She's brought in when one of the poor guys has to kick a penalty at just to win the game. They've drawn too many times now, but they haven't lost. And the team mascot, the Earl the dog, jumps up just as he's kicking the penalty, and you can work the rest out for yourself. So he's really upset about all that.
Yeah.
And this new psychologist comes in. She's bringing something new to the series, I would guess.
Yeah, she does, because I suppose upon her potential introduction, there's resistance from Ted, who doesn't really believe in sports psychology. Not sure he wants an outsider inside, and it brings a whole different dynamic. And she actually becomes quite a strong character in season two. She has quite an impact on the players and on the dressing room and even on staff around the place that you probably wouldn't have seen, and no one else in the club could have brought the dynamic that she does.
Well, let's listen to how Jason Sudeikis says Ted Lasso, how he greets her on her first day in the job, and being a psychologist, she just sits and watches.
Ted Lasso, welcome wagon has arrived.
Please don't barge in here like that.
I could have been in a session.
Oh, right, of course. I'm sorry.
Can I help you with something?
Well, yeah. No, I just brought you a little something for your first day of work.
No, thank you.
Oh, come on now. Just try a little bite, huh? There you go.
That's very thoughtful, Coach Lasso. But I don't eat sugar.
Really? Wow. I've never met someone who doesn't eat sugar. Only heard about them. And they all live in this godless place called Santa Monica.
Trust me, it's in everyone's best interest. In a past life, I would inhale a Cadbury's flake, talk nonsense for an hour until I pass out.
Well, I'm the same way with video games.
How so?
Oh, you know, it's just something in my life that I really enjoy. But then I pretend to prevent myself from having them and somehow making my life better. But in reality, all I'm doing is depriving myself of something that makes me happy instead of attempting to adjust my relationship to it.
Jason Sudeikis there as Ted Lasso, and it's Sarah Niles who plays the part of the new sports psychologist in Ted Lasso, the series that at least Fallon is speaking to us about this evening. Just as we finish up, Lisa, try to put yourself now in the non-football expert, you know, or somebody who has little or no interest in football. Do you think that they will get, is there enough in the series to pull that viewership in?
Oh, definitely. I mean, he's talking about his first training session where he's talking about we're going to do some 7v7, but I call it the Exorcist, and the players are going, what? And he goes, yes, because it's all about controlling possession. And it's just...
He's full of American references that they just don't get.
It really is. And it's funny, like, and one of my other favourite ones was where he's talking to his coach and they're talking about, again, a really serious issue. And then he just goes, yeah, he reminds me of someone in cleats. And the coach goes, they call him Boots. And he goes, they call cleats boots? And he was like, yeah, they call cleats boots. And he goes, I thought you said the trunk was the boot. And he's going, no, no. He said, yeah, the trunk is the boot. So he's going, he's like, so over here, they if I'm saying I'm putting my cleats in the trunk, they say they're putting their boots in the boot. And it brings it just that type of humour. And it's very funny.
Yeah, so you don't need to be a football expert.
You don't.
You don't need to understand the offside rule. You're okay.
He doesn't anyway, so it doesn't make a difference.
You'll be with Jason Sudeikis on that one.
Yeah.
You're recommending this, I think, probably without any...
Yeah, definitely, because I think as well as all the humour and the fun and the way it touches on fairly serious issues, there's lots of lovely little messages in it. And one of my favourite things is where they're being challenged about, you know, whether to do the right thing or the wrong thing. And one of his best quotes to Rebecca is, sometimes doing the right thing means you lose.
There you go.
It can leave you with some human stuff as well, which is really, really
nice. A little
nice bit
of philosophy in there too. Lovely to speak with you, Lisa, and thanks so much for watching it for us. Clearly you enjoyed yourself. Lisa Fallon speaking to us about Ted Lasso, the season 2, and Lisa has recommended that you go back and watch season 1 if you haven't seen it as well. It's available on Apple TV from this Friday. Gerald Dawes, the author of 9 collections of poetry, from his first collection, Sheltering Places in 1978, to his most recent, The Last Peacock, in 2019. And there was a selected poems in there as well. His new book, Imagined City, Belfast's Soundscapes, is the third and final volume of his Northern Chronicles trilogy, following on from the critically acclaimed In Another World, Van Morrison and Belfast, and the second in the series, Looking Through You. And Imagined City is a memoir that explores Gerald's early life in Belfast, celebrates some of the local writers whose early work had such an influential part in nudging him in the direction of writing. And the new book completes this rich portrait of the poet's tangled and ever-evolving relationship with his native city. And delighted to have Gerald with me in studio this evening. In fact, yes, those early writers are important, Gerald, but the first person that you really credit in terms of storytelling and opening up that whole world to you is your mother.
Yes. I mean, it's only when you sit down to bring all this material together, as I've done over the last five or more years, you start to think, I mean, what connects so many of the retrospective? And it's my mother. I mean, I used to travel in with her on the Antrim Road bus on Saturdays when we'd go in shopping. This was back in the 50s. And I mean, she used to literally talk. She'd talk to me.
Yeah.
In fact, she continued to talk to me for the rest of her life, and I've taken over from her. But I mean, she used to tell me stories about streets and about people that lived here. Or she would herself look back on her own life. I mean, she was still relatively a young woman in the 1950s, and she would refer to houses that she had lived in this area. So I suppose when we were putting these books together, and particularly this final one, A City Imagined, I think I kind of realised that was the reason why I started to want to transcribe what people said to me, conversation, how you would be auditing or hearing what people were saying. And I I was intrigued by that. And then as I became an adult myself, I actually started to realise that that was the reason why I actually became a writer.
Yeah, the reason for the poetry, maybe we'll get to that. That came a little bit later on.
Yeah.
But the other thing that struck me immediately in the book, the other thing that struck me quite strongly is how much you talk about, particularly in the 60s in Belfast, cultural diversity. Now, saving the people of Belfast and hoping not to insult them, it's not necessarily the first phrase that would jump out at me when I think about Belfast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was at a seminar a couple of years ago, mostly young scholars and writers and poets and so on. And I was sort of talking through this book, I mean, with them. And one of them said something which really kind of put me back on my heels. I was very impressed by the insight. He said to me that, are we now in the new 1960s? So what he was actually saying was that post Good Friday Agreement 1998, we're in the opportunity to actually register and celebrate and engage with a multicultural sense of Northern Ireland, and in particular in Belfast. And that sort of was where I got off in the 60s. I mean, we were always intrigued by blues music, black music, or, you know, the people who are around as they're trying to identify in the book. I mean, there were refugee families in the part of Belfast that I grew up in. And then I started to explore and find out and explore again through my mother that there was this element in our own family which had come from somewhere else and they were refugees and so on. So that diversity was kind of not spoken about. That word was not there.
Yeah.
Multiculturalism wasn't there. But actually under the refrigerated kind of blocks, the big power blocks, there was this other world going on. Neighbours of ours in the little terrace that we lived in. I mean, one was an Austrian lady, I talk about her in the book, who had married a Northern Ireland soldier who had liberated, been part of the liberation of Vienna. And I mean, there was a very strong Jewish community there. There was different kinds of Protestants there. There was the Catholic community, a very strong Catholic community. Anyway, I mean, with all this going on, and then what was happening globally with the 60s and the sense of music and the breakthrough.
It was a different place than maybe we associate with
exactly,
the Troubles period.
Exactly.
For sure.
But just to hop forward to your point then, I mean, my sense is that Belfast is reclaiming that kind of energy as of today, not 50 years ago, but as of today. The problem is that the politicians haven't caught up with it.
Yeah, in fact, you link a lot of it in the book. I won't go too far down this road, or we'll get to talk about nothing else. You link a lot of it into a European sensibility and how that might help things move forward, but that has to, obviously, Brexit and all of those things are playing.
Yeah, I mean,
that.
Brexit has thrown an awful hammer into the works.
Now, let us talk then about some of those early writers and, you know, names that I jotted down that won't be any surprise. Heaney, Mahon, Longley, Van Morrison and his lyrics,
yes,
which you wrote about in the first volume of the trilogy. But a name that won't be as familiar to people, but was, I think, hugely important to you, Pádraig Fíoch?
Yeah, well, his real name is Patrick Joseph O'Connor. I mean, he's no longer with us.
Yeah.
His writing name is Pádraig Fíoch. I met him in 1973. I was introduced to him by a Belfast poet, Brendan Hamill, and myself and a pal of mine, Aidan McPolan, met him in his house as he was living then in Glengormley. He was an extraordinary character. I mean, he looked very unusual for a start, as much as anything else. But without going into the details that the book has, I mean, this was a man who had followed a very traditional Irish immigrant path. On his father's side, they had come from Cavan, moved into Belfast, and from Belfast had moved to New York, the father had. And then Fíoch's mother took the family over to join him. And he spoke with a slightly quasi-American mid-Atlantic accent. He had gone to school in New York. He had read a lot of the New York modernists and those who had come from Eastern Europe to New York, he met and started to read. And here he was in a, in Glengormley, you know, playing Sibelius and so on, alongside Joseph Campbell. So he was a most unusual kind of presence. Now, his life story, I sketch in the book, and I won't go into it now. It's
a fascinating life
story. It is a fascinating one.
But to what extent him, and I've mentioned some of the others there, and I think Louis MacNeice is hugely important to it. What extent are they the people that then, and the, reading those words, were they the things that sent you towards poetry and writing?
No question about it. No question about it. I mean, we didn't... You're almost shy talking back then about what you were doing as a writer. I mean, I remember writing, getting a letter from Michael Longley and feeling like, my God, you know, this was 1966 or 67.
And was this the idea that, you know, as a young man growing up in Belfast, to be lyrical in any way would be laughed
at? It wasn't part of the deal, you know. Yeah. We were all supposed to go into industry, into manufacturing, into the civil service. I mean, that was the world that was in front of us. I was fortunate, the school I went to, there were some great teachers there, and they kind of opened up the door on being writers, actors.
Yeah, David Hammond, Sam MacReady.
Yeah. And so many of my contemporaries there went on to the media, to theatre, and continued that both in Ireland and in Britain. But it was down to those individuals.
Already the time is almost against us, but I don't want to finish up without talking about Brian Moore, because I think that is a hugely important part of your development as a writer. Yeah. Why? What is it about Brian Moore? You draw a great analogy between him and Joyce, in fact.
Oh, I mean, he's the coolest of cool writers. I met him once or twice. It was a pity I didn't know him better. He had he was very dapper. I mean, this was a guy who was a professional writer. Mm. That was his life. That was everything he did. And he had that kind of slightly ironic, wry, Belfast wit. I just clicked with the work. I love the work. 20 novels thereabouts. And he wasn't obsessed with himself in any way. He just loved the work. Mm. And I mean, anybody who wants to spend a summer just reading Brian Moore,
you could do worse things.
Your
mother was a great storyteller. The book is yet another piece of evidence that you can tell the story, the odd story yourself, Gerald. I must say there are some great anecdotes in there, and also great ideas that you have around the European ideal and how it might move things forward, and certainly well worth the read, and lovely to have you in with us this evening. That's Gerald Daw. A City Imagined is the title of the final book in the trilogy, Belfast Soundscapes. It's published by Merrion Press, and that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gar Duffy was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RTÉ Radio 1.